The Natural Resources Subcommittee of the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. This is Wednesday, April 27th, 2005. And we're here for a public hearing on House Bill 5056, which is the budget bill for the Oregon Parks and Recreation Department. We'll open a public hearing on House Bill 5056. And let's see here. Do you want to bring it, just kind of give us an idea of where we're going today, and then we'll call BAM and the department forward and begin to roll this out.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. This is phase two for the Parks Department. I will start with the overview of the governor's recommended budget and then move into the budget detail by the department. There are some materials that you have at your place go through. We'll be starting with this packet of information here, the governor's recommended budget. The agency will be using their presentation binder that they provided you during phase one for the details part. And then we'll move into performance measures, the revised performance measures. After hearing some of the committee's concerns, the agency went back and did some revisions and would like to present that to the committee today. And that should take care of most of today.
And committee members, you have a couple of reports bound with really cool pink paper clips here. And we'll be taking these up tomorrow. So you just have them for your advanced reading pleasure there. And with that, could we have BAM and the department come forward?
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the subcommittee. My name is Lisa Pearson with the Department of Administrative Services. And as was mentioned, this is the document I will be working from to provide a brief overview of the governor's recommended budget. And the agency will be following immediately afterward to supply the details. If you turn to page two, there is a couple of pie charts showing the total funds and general lottery funds for the Natural Resources Program Area. And you'll see that the Parks Department is about 12% of total funds and 29% of the general fund lottery funds. However, the Parks Department does not have any general fund in it, so this represents lottery funds. The next four pages are different views of the governor's recommended budget. And starting on page three, this view shows the different fund types. Other funds is the primary source of funding for the agency. And the sources for the other funds come from fee-for-services such as camping and day use fees. That represents the majority of that revenue. There are also RV registration fees, ATV operating permit revenues. There's some funding from the Oregon Marine Board for some work done developing and repairing boat docks and facilities. There's also some money that comes from the Department of Transportation for parks, roads, and rest stops. And there are some miscellaneous revenues. For example, there are some salmon plate revenues as well as some revenues from the rental of park property. Federal funds primarily comes from land and water conservation funds. There are also revenues from Historic Preservation Act and Recreational Trails Program and project grants. Non-limited, which is a very small piece of the pie there, includes such things as donations, lease rental receipts, sales of surplus land, camp firewood sales. This is something that I believe your staff will be recommending be moved into the limited other funds portion. So in 2007, you would not have this piece of the pie represented. You would have just the other funds piece. And then, of course, lottery funds comes from the Measure 66 ballot measure passed in 1998, and that provides for the department to be able to use the funding for various laid out purposes. If you turn to page four, this is a view of the various program units in the governor's recommended budget. Operations and facilities investments are the two largest, and together they represent about 64% of the governor's recommended budget. On page five, this view shows the various expenditure categories. Services and supplies is the largest for this agency, and that's a little different from some of the other agencies you've seen in natural resources before. The biggest reason for the services and supplies category to be as large as it is that agency program-related services and supplies, which include such things as the purchase of boat docks, day-use booths, yurt finishing and furnishing, parking lot trail costs, are included in the services and supplies category. And obviously, with the nature of the work that this agency does, that would include a lot of activity. Then the second largest category is personal services, and then the third largest would be special payments, and this is where you would find grants to other government units, such as tribal units, recreation districts, and then also cities and counties.
Representative Krieger.
The backlog that you had of maintenance and that type of thing, restoration, where is that in the budget?
Madam Chair, Representative Krieger, it is, there are, first of all, it's basically in facilities investment program unit, which is the previous page. And then in this particular slide, a good chunk of it would be in services and supplies. There would be some staff work associated with that, but a good piece of it would be in services and supplies. The other thing is, when the agency gets into more detail, there are some packages, and there is a package to increase the facility investment program expenditure limitation to continue to address that, but perhaps at a faster rate. On page 6, there is a chart or a table showing the historical expenditures as well as the governor's recommended budget. The changes over time include the elimination of general fund as part of this agency's budget. And then lottery funds and other funds have grown over time, which has allowed investments into facilities maintenance, new parks, recreation areas, historic sites or heritage sites. And also around the turn of this decade, the federal land and water conservation funding started flowing again, so that became available. The differences between the 2003-05 legislatively approved budget and the governor's recommended budget for 2005-07 primarily relate to those policy packages that I just mentioned. There's about $15.9 million of lottery fund between all of the packages and $2.2 million of other funds between all of the packages. And again, the agency will be going into more detail there. And then personal services, of course, increased because mainly because of the PERS rate change. And again, that will be reduced by legislative fiscal office because of the PERS rate change adopted by the board in February 2005. So you'll see a change there. And then also flex benefits or flexible benefits, which includes medical insurance and dental insurance, has gone up. If you turn to page 7, there's a short list of major policy issues, including managing long-term demand and resources, managing natural resources, heritage preservation, and workforce retention and workers' compensation. Turning to page 8, the major policy issues are addressed in the governor's recommended budget by some investments, including what I mentioned before, the facility investment program limitation increase, as well as some investments or resources for improving the stability of the workforce, and that would chiefly include engineers and geographic information systems. There's also a package to continue with the development of the L.L. Stewart State Park. That would be phase 2 of that. Then there's a package to provide staffing for what you know, has been developed and ready to open at the L.L. Stewart State Park under phase 1, as well as three new sites, including Thompson's Mills, Fort Yamhill, and Crissy Field. There's also a package for Coastal Parks and Beaches workforce, and this is intended to improve public safety, also to reduce negative impacts on resources and on other citizens at the beaches. Turning to page 9, there is a package that would put resources into modernizing the reservation system. The system is old enough now that it is really no longer supported or shortly will not be by any vendor. And then there's also a package to provide funding for the Department of Forestry to have some interpretive positions at its Tillamook Interpretive Center. Page 10, reductions. This agency did take the standard reductions for statewide administrative savings, purchasing savings. But other than that, there were no forced savings for this agency. Also, there are no fee or revenue issues. And then finally, on page 11, there are a number of technical adjustments that we would request. And the first one is that there was a phase out of the financial management system progress or project costs, and that was a little overstated, and so it would be recommended that $220,968 of lottery fund limitation be added back. Then on the recreational vehicle revenue transfer to counties, the agency has a competitive county opportunity grant program, and it retains about 10% of the overall revenues available. That wasn't retained, and so that would be about $1.1 million of other funds that would be brought back and reduced as the revenue transfer out to counties and would remain within the budget so that it could be granted out. The third issue is a reclassification due to a classification study. This was a timing issue. This was underway but was not finished by the time Governor's recommended budget was due to be published and laid out statewide. And that would increase lottery funds limitation by about $37,000 and would reduce other funds limitation by about $6,500. The fourth issue is Oregon Youth Conservation Corps. It's the right number, it's the wrong fund type, and it's in the wrong program unit. And so what we would like to ask is that that be corrected. And then the last three issues have to do, again, essentially with timing. When the governor's recommended budget was put together, it was almost 6 months ago. And at that time, the agency wasn't aware that there was going to be some carryover, that some projects and grants were not going to be completed by the end of this current biennium. And that affects the Lewis and Clark Bicentennial package from this biennium. There's a local grant to Kaiser and archaeological surveys. And what we would request is that $150,000 of limitation be carried over for the Lewis and Clark Bicentennial into 2005-07, that $500,000 be carried over for the Kaiser grant, and that $50,000 be carried over for the archaeological grants. As I said, the agency will shortly be getting into all of the details, but I would be happy to answer any questions, or try to at least, if you have any.
Questions or comments? Thank you very much. Mr. Wood, please proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Tim Wood. I'm the Director of the Oregon Parks and Recreation Department. And if I may just take a minute to introduce Bill Gregory and his wife, Marie. Bill is one of our Parks and Recreation Commissioners who come to observe this the hearing this afternoon. So.
Thank you very much for joining us. And also, please accept our thanks for all of the time that you volunteer to the Parks Department on behalf of the people of Oregon. We really appreciate your contribution.
Madam Chair, can I make a comment?
Yes.
Bill Gregory and I first met about 15 years ago. He was the original chair for the Health Services Commission, which laid out the prioritized list for the health care plan. And he chaired that commission for, I think, almost 3 years. 3 years, our most formative and difficult years. He did that on a volunteer basis. He had his timber company in down in Roseburg, and then left that and has gone on to other pursuits. I'd like to point out this gentleman has given 15 to 20 years of his life in volunteer work for the state, and this is just one of the things he's done for us. He's an exceptional individual, and he and I had not seen each other, I don't think, for 10, 11, 12 years. And I'm glad to see you again, and I didn't know you were doing this now, too. You never quit. Thank you very much, Bill.
We don't, I think, say thank you often enough for the people that do give their expertise and their time to the state. So please accept again our thanks for what you do.
Madam Chair, Lisa gave a very good overview of what's to come. We'll provide the details to those packages. She provided a brief overview of what our revenue sources are, so I won't go into that again. We have 14 packages in our original governor's recommended budget, And again, they include packages to increase funds to the facility investment program for construction of the Stuart State Park, for the establishment of positions and startup costs for new properties, conversion of some limited duration positions to permanent, and funds to plan and organize the state's sesquicentennial celebration.
Representative Krieger.
Are we have the same book that he has?
Representative Krieger, yes. We'll be going through the tabs starting with operations here in just a second. These were some introductory notes I had.
We have a reputation for getting lost in the paperwork, so it'd be very helpful to us if you could point us to where we're supposed to go.
So we're in this book, and very shortly we'll be at the operations tab.
You gotta tell us where to go.
Get used to that
as we move through.
So in addition to the 14 packages that were part of our original governor's recommended budget, we will be asking or adding an additional two packages for your consideration. And those came out of some of the discussion we had in our phase one when we talked about some increased revenue due to lottery growth, and we will propose a package on how we would use those funds. The way I would propose that we do this is that, just for a reminder, we are organized into three sort of organizational divisions: operation, heritage conservation division, and administration. And so that's the way we'll make our presentation of our packages. And so the assistant directors for each of those divisions will give you a very brief overview of responsibilities just for context, and then jump into the packages for each of those divisions. And so with that, we'll start with Dave Wright, who is the assistant director for operations.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, good afternoon. Thank you for having us today. I'm Dave Wright. I'm the Assistant Director for Operations, and the Operations Division accounts for about 67% of the total parks budget. That includes the day-to-day maintenance and management of the parks themselves, management of our volunteer programs, management of our natural resource and planning processes, and some special programs like the State Scenic Waterway Program, the Lower Deschutes River Recreation Management Area, and the Ocean Shores Program. Operations also includes the Facility Investment Program, which is referred earlier as a pretty big chunk of our budget, as well as a partnership we have with the Department of Corrections. We provide about $2.5 million out of that Facility Investment Program for prison crews and products that the corrections can supply to the Parks Department, anything from campfire rings, picnic tables, to cabins. So it's been a real good partnership for us. I'm going to skip over to page 22, which is really our the beginning of the program option packages that we're requesting. Now, the first one, package 110, is it's labeled the Harris Canyon Development, but this park has recently been renamed to the L.L. Step Stewart Memorial State Park. And we are asking for a package to do a second phase major construction of that park so that we can have it ready for opening in the spring of 2007. This package requests $8,099,993 out of the Facility Investment Program, and it buys us about 7,800 miles worth of road, a couple campground loops, water and sewer infrastructure, and it would have one limited duration position that would be accompanying that package. This is the first new major state park that has been developed since about 1978, and because of the terrain, it's a little bit more expensive than what we would hope other new state park developments might be, but this package will get us to a point where we would be able to open it in the spring of 2007. Moving on to package 120 and 121, we've combined those in this paragraph. We have currently seven limited duration positions that we're asking to be made permanent. These really are in support of the Facility Investment Program. Most of the people that are involved in these programs are really contract managers, because we run a lot of contracts through the Facility Investment Program. So this would include three engineer types that would be project managers, a contract specialist position, and half-time natural resource specialist that helps out with our planning and design, as well as a program manager who helps, or a program tech position that helps us track our facility investment projects. These positions are currently in place as limited duration, and one of the things that we're finding is that it's pretty hard to recruit good people when they are only assured of a couple years. So we believe that by making these permanently, we can have better retainage. People will be more willing to invest in us, and we can invest in them.
Are there positions that are vacant at the present time?
Two of them are vacant at this time. One of them, a construction inspector. That person recently took a job as a park ranger in the gorge, and then the contract and procurement specialist is a vacant. That's also limited duration, so it's filled. Excuse me, there's one that's vacant.
So one is vacant, and how long have they been limited duration, these positions?
And Madam Chair, we've had them for the full biennium. I think the contract and procurement specialist is fairly recent, within the last 6 months that we brought that one on.
Okay, so all but one have been in place for one biennium. One's been in place for only 6 months.
Correct, Madam Chair.
Okay, thank you. Please proceed.
Moving on to package 150, this is really staffing for four new park properties that these staff will be brought in, phased in over the course of the biennium as we roll these parks out for the opening. This is on page 23. The first one is Harris Canyon or L.L. Stubb Stewart State Park. This is an 1,800-acre state park that we are in the process of building. We talked about that at the package 110. We're asking for six positions, which equates to 2.27 FTEs. The Fort Yamhill State Heritage Area is a property that we've owned for a while, but we're in the process of working with the Grand Ronde Tribe to develop an interpretive site, as well as the tribe will be doing some development on their adjacent land. And we're hoping to have this open in the spring of 2006 in time for the Lewis and Clark commemoration. This would request four positions, which, because most of these are seasonal positions, it really equates to 1.41 FTEs. The Thompson Mill State Heritage Site is in Linn County in Shedd, close to Shedd. It's a historic grist mill that we recently acquired, and we're requesting two positions, 1.13 FTEs for that. And the final one is for Chrissy Field down on the southern Oregon coast. This is a property that we acquired a few years ago, and we're partnering with federal and local agencies to develop a visitor center, kind of a welcome to Oregon State Park, where we can showcase the state and have some partners involved. We're asking for two positions that equate to half an FTE to help with staffing that welcome center. And as I said, these positions will be phased in over the course of the biennium so that not all will be immediately put on board. Moving on to package 180, unless there are any questions about that one. 170, I'm sorry. Package 170 is the one that Lisa talked about to increase our facility investment program by $6 million to help us speed up reducing the backlog of deferred maintenance that exists within the department. The current backlog is estimated at about $66 million. We expect it to be about $53 million at the end of 2005-2007. This would help us speed that up. So that's a $6 million of additional lottery funds that we're requesting.
The third phase budget discussions, can you bring us some kind of information that we can use to gauge what we're going to buy with this additional money and how it's going to change the long-range plans of the agency with relationship to the maintenance schedule?
I'm sure, certainly.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, Committee, package 180 is another request for 3 park rangers to assist in management of the Ocean Shore area. We recently have completed a almost 3-year process to develop an Ocean Shore management plan as well as a habitat conservation plan for the western snowy plover. This was a planning process that had extensive public involvement. We had, I think, 3 rounds of public hearings at 7 different locations up and down the coast. And one of the things that people pointed out to us was, and that we already knew, was a need to really increase our presence on the ocean shore for visitor services, safety, and natural resource management issues. So we're asking for 3 positions, park ranger positions, that we could have basically focused on the ocean shore. And this would be from lottery funds and some other funds, and the majority would be other funds. Package 190 is entitled Natural Resource Enhancement. A couple sessions ago, prior to Measure 66, where the department got lottery funds, there was a bill that passed that provided the department with half of the revenue from salmon license plates. And the statute required that that money be used for park operations and maintenance, acquisition, and basically feeding and caring of the park system. But so it became part of our base budget and was just distributed amongst our park to help with our operating costs. It became apparent the next session that the sponsor of that bill really had intended that that be used for salmon fish enhancement projects within state parks, and subsequently he introduced or had introduced some other legislation that requires us to report back to you on how we spend that money, and we'll be talking about that report tomorrow. But the problem we have had with this is because it's part of our operating fund, we really had never set it aside for natural resource enhancement. So what we're asking you to do is allow us to set aside $341,178, which we would also leverage other funds and focus on natural resource projects within the state parks.
So do you envision using this $341,000 on some specific projects, or are you just going to spread it through the system? How are you going to achieve the goal?
Madam Chair, the natural resource needs of this department are great because, you know, when you have a lot of people tromping through the brush and when you've had a lot of culverts in place that are wearing out, what we've done in the past is distributed it to each area and asked them to spend it on projects that would increase fish passage or protect riparian areas along streams. And we have, you know, plenty of projects out there that we can do. We do have a natural resource person on staff that will help those areas prioritize what projects they do and help find other funding that can be leveraged against the amount that we have.
If the legislature adopts this package, we're going to need to figure out some kind of a measure to gauge whether this is functioning the way that it should. So that may be a piece of something to consider there as we move through the process.
And Madam Chair, the statute wouldn't change. We would still need to report back to you on how this money is spent.
Representative Krieger.
Yeah. I had some conversations directly regarding the ocean shore controversy regarding the snowy plover in the South Coast. I'd like to know the number of miles of beach that are closed. And there was quite a controversy as to why it was ever, that the HCP was ever put into process. I took part in the one where we were developing it for the Board of Forestry. I was on the Board of Forestry. I followed that through and I knew what we're doing. I knew the public input process and the fact that they'd come to this body with the HCP. I don't remember the HCP being an issue last year here. To the degree that it happened in between in the bienniums, we ended up with thing of closures on the beaches. Had met somewhat with the former director. There seemed to be a real difference of opinion as to whether this was going to move forward because there was such an upwelling against it from the majority of the people, but then all of a sudden it did move forward. I think we need to have a conversation about how that came about. the cost of developing that, because I know what it costs to develop the one for the forest plan, and what funds were used for that, and just what's in that HCP is how it's going to affect Oregon's beaches and the people who want to use them.
Madam Chair, Representative Krieger, the first question about how much of the beaches closed during the nesting season. Right now, it's just a little less than 18 miles. It hasn't changed for the last several years. The plan proposes that ultimately, it's divided the beach up into basically occupied sites where plovers have been nesting and unoccupied sites. And the occupied sites, the plan suggests that up to 32 miles could be closed in the occupied sites. But what they really do is they put symbolic fencing around those nesting sites and ask people to stay a couple hundred yards away from them. So the thought that all 32 miles would be closed is probably not ever going to happen. The plan also suggests that we ought to take some actions in some of these historic nesting sites where the plovers aren't right now, and it designates about 16 miles of unoccupied areas where we wouldn't close the beach, but we would start taking some measures to educate the public about, being careful in case a bird does show up in that site, to do some habitat restoration to see if it would attract birds. And I think the only restrictions we call for, which really don't have any impact, are because they're in place already, are no vehicles in those unoccupied areas. And then the other one was requiring dogs to be on leash in those unoccupied areas. With regard to the reason we went forward with the plan is we really looked at it as a way to provide some certainty to the public on, and once we had this plan in place, this is it. We don't have to worry about plovers in any area other than those that are outlined in the plan. Secondly, it's really an insurance policy because individuals, the state, we could all be liable under the ESA if we harassed or harmed a western snowy plover. And by doing this, it allows us to apply to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service for an incidental take permit. So if people are recreating on the beach and they just so happen to scare a plover off its nest, they're not going to be in trouble because we'll be covered. It's like an insurance policy. As far as the cost of this plan, a good share of it was paid for by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. I can't give you the exact number of what it costs. I think it was the total cost of the plan is probably in the range of $250,000 to $500,000. But like I say, most of it was paid for from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. We have not fully implemented that plan for the HCP because before we do that, we have to do an environmental impact statement, which the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is also funding. And we haven't started that process, so even if we started today, it probably wouldn't be done for 18 months to 2 years before we actually start implementing any of the measures that are outlined in the HCP. And a lot could happen between now and then. We're still waiting to find out whether the feds are going to delist the western snowy plover. There was a petition to delist, and we haven't received word on that yet. But
does that delisting have to do with the fact that they're genetically the same throughout the range? Part of that was the argument?
Madam Chair, Representative Krieger, that's correct. There apparently are a lot of western snowy plovers in Salt Lake City, or Salt Lake, and a lot in western Oregon. And the way the Fish and Wildlife Service is, they're looking at the coastal population as being a distinct population, and there just isn't enough information up to this point to determine whether or not they're moving back and forth across the mountain ranges.
So if the plover is delisted, what actions will that trigger within the department with reference to the measures that you've already put in place?
Madam Chair, more than likely, some of these measures we would keep in place. The bird will still be listed as a state species, or listed threatened in the state. And under the state listing, it's all population, whether it's east or west of the Cascade. So we still have some management requirements that are just good natural resource management to protect the bird, unless the state Fish and Wildlife made the decision to delist. If that happened, then we would probably revisit the plan, and there are still some sound management actions I think we need to do just in preserving habitat. But whether or not we'd go forward with the closures of the beach during the nesting season is something that we'd have to take up with our commission and with the public.
There are people in my district who have spoken to me about the predation issue around the plover. Has the Parks Department done anything in that regard?
Madam Chair, we do participate with the federal agencies and state fish and wildlife in, and funding for some of that predation work that is being done. We hire, through a joint agreement, the U.S. Department of Agriculture, APHIS, that goes out and they report to us on how many skunks they've trapped and foxes they've dispatched, et cetera. So, and that seems to be making quite this past year was a great year for the plover, a larger increase in population than we've seen in many years. So part of the actions that have been taken with regard to the restrictions during the use or during the nesting season, the habitat restoration that's been done, and the predator management all contribute, we believe, to that. And, you know, hopefully that's going to continue to a point where even if the bird stays listed, it will recover a lot faster than expected, and we wouldn't have a need for this HCP.
Representative Schaffer.
Thank you. So just so I get this straight, you have to bear with me, but so they're not just at the beach. They can technically be all over the state. And is the and if their population is not healthy on the beach but is somewhere else, just because they're endangered on the beach, they'd be endangered all statewide. And we could possibly, potentially, they'd never be off the dangerous list if they were never back at the beach again. Is that all possible?
Madam Chair, Representative Schaffler, I suppose it's possible that it would not ever recover, because in Oregon, I think there's larger populations in Utah around the Great Salt Lake. In Oregon, there are some. There is a population that over in the Malheur Refuge, I believe. But the bottom line is it's listed as threatened across the state of Oregon by this the state listing, the state ESA. So.
Senator Krieger.
About 18 miles. Describe to us where it's located.
Madam Chair, Representative Krieger, I don't know if I could. Actually, maybe I can. I can't give you the exact numbers. I think I did make a copy of a page out of the plan that talks about what areas are proposed for the occupied sites. And currently, the restrictions only are only on those occupied sites. And
rather than look for it, Madam Chair, they're fairly remote areas, mostly in Coos and Curry County.
That's correct.
The thing we've always been trying to put out is it's probably not man that's having the effect on the population to start with. There's nobody there. We're down the mouth of Flores Creek and that country up there near the northern part of Curry County. Once in a while in the winter, someone goes down the beach. Not that total traffic is light, so probably the predation problem, whether it be from skunks or foxes or whatever. When I got there, there wasn't a fox in Curry County. Guess what? So the habitat hasn't really changed that much, but the prey, predation, is probably the biggest single thing there is. And I know they did some work and took some animals. I think some crows or ravens or something were involved, and I think probably we're getting a much better recovery just from doing that than we would have dreamed possible, because we didn't realize the impact that they were having.
Madam Chair, Representative Kruger, I wouldn't disagree with you. I think the habitat does play a role too, because the beach grass grows up and provides cover for those foxes and skunks and whatnot. So when they've gone in and scraped off that beach grass and created new habitat, it's actually provided extra benefit for the birds. So.
Survival potential of something that lays its eggs and incubates its young right on the ground.
I'm curious to just a couple of quick questions.
Yeah.
How long is the season that needs to be closed down, and is it is the breeding season a short one or a long one?
Madam Chair, Senator Bates, it's actually, unfortunately, it coincides with the heavy recreation use season on the beach. It runs from about March 15th through September 15th. But what we have worked out what we have worked out with the federal agencies is that if the birds don't begin nesting at a particular site, we'll relax those restrictions early. So about July 15th, we'll start re-evaluating what's happening on the beach. And you should also understand that the wet sand area, where people traditionally like to walk anyway, is always open. It's not closed. So it's only the dry sand area that's restricted.
Let's proceed.
Madam Chair, package 230 is a request for some to transfer some funds to the State Department of Forestry so that they can fund four interpretive positions at the new Tillamook Forest Interpretive Center. This was a result of a budget note in the state forestry budget last session, and we have worked with them and identified that their mission melds with ours with regard to interpretation, and we're fine with providing them some funding to provide two seasonal interpretive specialists and two interpretive interns.
And what are student professional workers? Are those professional students or professional workers?
Madam Chair, I believe those are students who like to be called professional. But they're probably graduate students that are studying some kind of natural resource management that can provide interpretation. And it's also a way for the state to pay a little bit less for their services than you might pay for a natural resource specialist.
How much money they've raised for that interpretive center from, you know, gifts and other type things, not using state dollars. I think Stubb Stewart gave $50,000.
I actually have.
So that's interesting how they've been able to do that.
Package 250, I think this may have been a handout for you. It wasn't in the initial package. This is really because of the line games, lottery line games. The Office of Economic Analysis has reprojected the lottery revenue, and as of February 25th revenue report, our forecast, they anticipate about 11,291,424 additional lottery revenue that would be allocated to state parks. And so we are asking for extra spending limitation. What we would use this money for is we argued internally on how we should, who could present this, because everyone wanted to say the word to fees. What we would like to do is to fees our lottery bond. And we have all learned that means that it would annul that bond, and it would require a payment of that new revenue of about $5,791,424 to accomplish that defeasance. So it really takes about $10.5 million to deposit into an escrow account that would really be used to pay the debt service until we could make that full, until that bond could be retired, which is in 2008, I think April 2008. Of that $10.5 million that would be required, $1.6 million is already in a reserve account. $3.2 million is what we have been budgeted for paying off that bond, and like I said, an additional $5.7 million would be required to fill out that escrow account in order to retire that bond. But it really gets it off of our plate, and it would have the bond retired early and ultimately save the department about $1.8 million over the course of that bond. We would also propose using about $1 million of that in our about $3.5 million in the facility investment program. $1 million would go to the first phase infrastructure repairs at the Cove Palisades State Park over in Central Oregon. $1 million would be put into Silver Falls State Park here in Marion County to accelerate our infrastructure repairs. $500,000 would go to Fort Stevens State Park to kind of finish out that project with regard to major infrastructure needs. And $3 million would be invested in the new L.L. Stubb Stewart State Park and hopefully finish that park in total this biennium.
Senator. Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick comment. I appreciate the department looking at the defeasance issue. I think I got you started down that path, and I never realized where we were going because I was so deeply into it I couldn't get back out again. And I learned more about retiring bonds than I ever wanted to learn. They had several really difficult decisions to make here, depending on how you want to spend the money. One was to continue your programs against paying off the bond. And there are several ways to pay off the bond that led you to different paths also. I think the one you've chosen is by far the best. Sort of in the middle ground, allows you to pay the bond off early, allows you to save some money, but allows you to continue your present program basically without having to roll them back at all. So I think you've made a good decision here, and I appreciate you working on this with me. Thank you.
I think the final package we have for you today is package 260, which is really requesting a position. It is part of your handout also. ODOT, the Department of Transportation, is proposing to transfer the Ophir Rest Area to the State Parks and Recreation Department. This is a rest area down in Curry County. It really serves as a beach access, and they sweeten the pot and entice us to take this on. They have offered us a position that could be used to help manage that. So we would ask your approval for this one FTE to manage the Ophir Rest Area and do other things for the department.
Madam Chair, how many people know what Ophir is? Know what Ophir is? That's where my wife was born. My front yard.
You guys have gone too far now.
Madam Chair,
yes.
Is the Department of Transportation planning to transfer the properties to you, or are you just going to manage it?
Madam Chair, Susan, I believe they're going to transfer it in fee to us. This is part of a larger package where we're doing some exchanges with them where we're going to take on a couple roads that lead to Cape Sunset Beach State Park and Cape Blanco. They're going to transfer a couple other properties to us at Otter Point down in Curry County and the Ophir Rest Area. So it's
kind of a land exchange?
It's not really. It's more of a jurisdictional exchange because State Parks isn't giving up a whole lot. We're taking on these things, and they're actually part of the package is that they basically figure out how much they would have spent initially and to take care of those properties over the course of a period of time and offset that cost by giving us the land. So we're adding land to the park system, but not really giving up any land.
Senator Bates.
I'm not sure if I can understand this, but I know the Cape Blanco area pretty well. Are you taking over the road that goes into it, or are you expanding the park itself there?
We're actually taking over the road when you hit the state park boundary. Right now, it's a state highway all the way down through the park, and once you hit the state park boundary, it's still a considerable amount of road
there. Right, we're back in there quite a way.
Right.
Now.
So we would take on that portion within the park.
What's the advantage to you to do that?
Madam Chair, Senator Bates, there really isn't a huge advantage other than we get a piece of property, the Otter Creek property, which is really a nice scenic wayside stop. And
paying this for that, then, basically.
Basically, that's what it amounts to.
Please proceed.
I believe that is it for the operations packages.
We'd move next to the next tab, which is the Heritage Conservation Division, and James Hamrick is the director for the Heritage Conservation. We'll walk us through that.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, subcommittee members. James Hamrick. I'm the Assistant Director of Parks in charge of the Heritage Conservation Division, which essentially is both internal and external programs relating to heritage. The division's been managing federal and state heritage programs since the late 60s. We are the state's primary heritage service provider. The 0507 budget with the program option packages and technical adjustments would come up to about 5.2 $5.25 million, or 2.9% of the total. So we're small in size, but powerful in impact and outreach. Our federal programs are authorized by the 1966 National Historic Preservation Act, shortly followed therein by ORS 358, 390, and ORS 97, which are most of our state authorities. We have a statewide program with various authorities over state and federal public lands. We assist with the development and interpretation of the large number of heritage resources in the state park system. We provide consulting services to the facility investment program, for instance. We award grants to citizens, nonprofits, local jurisdictions to support construction, local preservation programs and projects, and events such as the Lewis and Clark Bicentennial. We administer state and federal tax incentives for restoration and rehabilitation of historic properties, including the Special Assessment for Historic Properties Program, which is the nation's oldest tax incentive for historic properties. We are the only state agency that is authorized to issue archaeological permits in Oregon. We have substantial interaction on an ongoing basis with Oregon tribal governments. We are a partner agency with the Oregon Cultural Trust, and we oversee the following boards and commissions: the Oregon Heritage Commission, which is going to be in charge of the sesquicentennial, State Advisory Committee on Historic Preservation, the relatively unique nationally Oregon Commission on Historic Cemeteries, the Oregon Historic Trails Advisory Council, and the Historic Columbia River Highway Advisory Committee. So if you all have any questions, I'm going to turn over to page 30 and get started on the packages. Madam Chairman, package 140 relates to adjustments to existing five existing positions in the Heritage Conservation Division. A lot of these requests come as a result of workload increases that have been confirmed over a period of time. The limited duration positions that are in this package, if they were approved as limited durations again, would be the third biennium, which they were, in fact, made limited duration. And so a couple of them are requested to be made permanent. The Cemetery Commission coordinator is a permanent half-time position. When the program was first started in 1999, it was considered, I think, or in long-range planning, that once the commission got going and the programs got going and it got moving, that in fact we would need a full-time person. That has really been the case. A program is phenomenally successful. We also now have a grants program and training program in place, all of which is trying to be managed not so very well by a half-time position. And so we would ask that position be bumped up to full-time. We have an information specialist position that also is several biennia old as a limited duration position, which we had asked to be made permanent. What we've been doing over the last few years is to combine all of our databases, sort of a public service sort of aspect to this, combine all of our databases, turn them into a relational database so that they can all talk to each other and update each other at the same time, but also to allow us to turn this into a web-based sort of thing so that people outside can use our databases to do record searches and research and other sorts of things. We also are going to expand that program into a geographic information system framework, which will essentially, in the long run, substantially increase efficiency and customer service. The state archaeologist position, this is also one that is in at the end of its second biennium. There has been a substantial increase in the need for archaeology under state law relating not in small part to the OTIA bridge replacement program at the Department of Transportation. We used to issue, for instance, in 2001, we were issuing about 45 archaeological permits a year, just a little, about one a week. We're now issuing or have issued in 2004 about 135 of those. These are incredibly labor-intensive. They require consultation with local governments, Indian tribes, et cetera. And it is basically, we practically need a single person just to do archaeological permits, and that's not the only thing that the archaeologists do. They also review federal undertakings, archaeological-based undertakings on federal lands as well. The other piece of this, we would ask that that position be made permanent, and we would also ask that it be reclassed up to a natural resource specialist 4. The only other archaeological positions in the state are mostly at ODOT, and those people are at NRS 4 levels. We've had some trouble competing with them for professionals. Because we've been unable to match the salary range, and so that is why we had requested this be bumped up to Natural Resource Specialist 4. We have two limited duration halftime positions, one in the National Register of Historic Places program and the other in the what we refer to as review and compliance, which essentially is a review of federal projects and undertakings statewide. Relating to the review and compliance program, because of changes in federal law that occurred a couple of years ago, plus increasing compliance with federal agencies, the workload, project workload, for instance, in 2003 was 2,712 projects reviewed, and the projections for 2005, based upon existing information, about 3,581 projects. So what, and so in terms of this one half-time position for the review and compliance program, that person has been working full-time for at least the last year. And then finally, the National Register program person, essentially requests by constituents, more technical assistance needed as local governments. There are more grassroots nominations to the National Register and less professional and ones that are initiated by local governments, and it's just really increased the workload quite a bit. So these four positions at 4.5 FTE, the net cost, it says here, $572,000 and some change, but the net cost or net increase cost would actually be $188,000 since these are positions that are already in the budget. Shall I proceed? Madam Chairman, you also have a additional sheet that was in your package on in your handouts on package 160, which is the revision to the Oregon sesquicentennial package. This package, in 19th of March 2004, Governor charged the Oregon Heritage Commission to take the lead in planning and coordinating the state's sesquicentennial celebration, which I can now say really fast without it took me a while. This package originally requested $150,000. After meetings with advisory committees and professionals and other sorts of things that have been ongoing and are ongoing right now, the governor's office requested that we put a additional $269,000 in lottery funds into the package so that, in fact, we would be able to come up with a complete product that would be implemented in the sesquicentennial year of 2008-2009. So essentially, this is the difference between a guesstimate, the $150,000, and the the larger figure is in fact based on professional input and data from constituents. Package 210, page 31, package 210. In 1989, former Secretary of State Norm Paulus took a advisory committee in the General Services Department and turned it into the Historic Properties Commission. She envisioned a sort of a Secretary of State in, say, Washington, where they collect antiques, and they have one of the most spectacular collections of antiques in the world. And Secretary Paulus sort of envisioned the same thing. So in addition to determining what we had actually in existing state agency collections and capital and other things, what we actually had, she actually also solicited people to donate historic artifacts to the state. After 1993, that program was transferred over to the Oregon Historical Society, and then in 1995 it was transferred to us without any budget or staffing. And so essentially what we've been trying to do, or what we need to do, this is a paper-based inventory. It's really sitting in boxes in my office. It's a mess. And what we would like to do with this contract, $50,000 in contract funds, one-time contract funds, is to essentially go back to the agencies, find out where this stuff is, or confirm that it's still there, digitize all of our inventories, create a database, determine whether we should actually start a sort of permanent state collection, sort of a museum collection, and then deaccession some of the things, basically, that we don't need. For instance, in your chambers, every desk that in the House and Senate chambers has a historic properties tag. But also, every wooden file cabinet in state government also has a historic properties tag. Do we need to preserve these things or protect them? And so essentially this package would get that piece going.
Senators have those tags too, aren't
they? I was thinking about Rocco's waste basket.
Yes, I was thinking of certain members of the legislature probably, myself included, probably have a tag on them.
Madam Chair,
if you really need a certified.
Madam Chair, Senator Bates, if you go into the new wings and go upstairs and look at all that foam furniture and the cubes, coffee tables, they all have historic property tags on them.
It's eggplant colored sofas.
Correct. Correct. And so essentially what we would like to do is just kind of compress this all and really make it something that the state could be proud of.
Are these barcodes right out here what you're talking about?
Madam Chair, Representative Shoffler, no. Oh. But if you look on your desk in the chambers, I think they're sort of bronzy looking. It says Historic Properties Commission on it.
Huh. Madam Chair,
can you check the bottom of your shoes?
I assume that some of these artifacts probably really do have historic value.
Yeah,
there's probably some pretty nice stuff. That's what you got to winnow that out from the rest of it, probably.
Madam Chairman, Senator Bates, that's exactly what we'd like to do. I mean, for instance, that table in the governor's ceremonial office with the state capitol on it, which was custom made for this building when it was constructed, that is relatively rare and probably semi-priceless sort of antique. And there are probably other things like it. It's ironically the state surplus in their offices, if you've ever been over there, it's sort of bare. But they have historic light fixtures that were surplused from this building, which they just attached to the walls and hooked up. And so that's that kind of thing that we would like to sort of try to figure out, take care of. And finally, Madam Chairman, the last package. We currently have a bill before that is passed the Senate, which would
take the old museum grant program that was initially created in 1965 and transferred over to us in 1995. We are asking the Senate and the House to change that program from one that it's an entitlement program, where they take the money, divide it up amongst qualified museums, and write up checks. And in this case, last year the checks were only $270 a piece. In 1965, there was $50,000 put into this program, and it was never increased over the years. And when we got it back, we got it in 1995, there was still $50,000 in it. In 1965, there were 12 museums statewide. There are now over 200. And so, in essence, the Oregon Heritage Commission, which is in charge of this grant program, Oregon Historical Society, and the Oregon Museums Association got together and decided in a collaborative way in 2001 that they wanted to turn this from an entitlement to a competitive grant program. And that bill is moving forward. And so this package would sort of give some momentum to that by adding $50,000 biennium to make the program $100,000 instead of $50,000.
So would the size of the money that was available to grant, would it increase to $100,000 and just be flat at that level?
At this point, Madam Chairman, yes. I think unless we could make a good argument that it needed that it was working and it needed to be increased at some other point in time in the future. The idea is also to protect by rule the smaller museums that used to, that like those $270 checks by rulemaking, make sure that they are get a certain cut out of the money, and then the other things which would actually fund real projects and we think be more accountable and more transparent would be with the rest of the funds.
There was a, I think you might be able to answer my question. I mean, if there was, I was in Klamath Falls 2 years ago, and they had there was a museum down there that had a great Western exhibit.
Fable.
Pardon me?
Fable Museum. Is that, private museum.
Is that, you know, they were trying to get somebody to buy that. Did we get involved in that as a state or not? That's a great exhibit.
I'm Chairman Representative Schaffler. That was a private museum, and it was for sale. And I honestly don't know what the outcome of that was, but I do believe that they were or would be eligible for our $270 grant last year, which might pay their phone bill.
Forgive me, Madam Chair.
Please proceed.
Madam Chairman, that is
that's it.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Any more questions?
Thank you, Madam Chair. We'll move now to administration, and our Assistant Director for Administration is Janet Tindall.
And, of course, this is the most exciting part, Madam Chair, members of the committee.
Absolutely.
Where we are?
For the record, my name is Janet Tindall. I am the Assistant Director of Administration. And as this is put together, this actually encompasses two pieces of our operations, which is our grants program as well as the sort of back office administrative functions. We have five grant programs. They're all competitively based and are all allocated out based on advice from committees that are representing of those types of programs and folks who are receiving the grants. They're primarily for recreation-type acquisitions, enhancements, no maintenance kinds of things, with the exception of the all-terrain vehicle program, where we do fund some maintenance, and we also help fund some enforcement activities with that grant program. In terms of the traditional administrative-type functions, we have four major components, and the policy oversight of the agency, of course, is our director and our commission. And we do have a seven-member commission that's representing the five congressional districts as well as two at-large members. We also have an internal audit position that's part of the director's office, and that person does monitor a lot of the activities that go on in our parks as well as in our central offices and the grants and contracts, and she's a very, very busy person. We also have financial services, which is responsible for all of our accounting, budget, payroll activities, and personnel, which is responsible for recruiting, retaining, training, and also making sure that we're safe in our operations, and they also do risk management for us to make sure that our visitors are safe as well. We have an information systems division, and it's a small group of folks that manage our desktop activities and help us with connectivity to the Department of Administrative Services and their systems. We have, as was mentioned earlier, a small financial management system that interfaces to the state system. And we also have a geographic information system that just started last biennium. We also, in this program, capture all of our central government charges, our attorney general charges, and the rent for our headquarters office building. And then we have a couple of areas that are sort of externally focused, and those are our public services department. They're responsible for putting out our publications, our information to visitors, responding to questions, looking at marketing activities and ways that we can promote the services that we do provide. And then our Reservations Northwest is our registration program, and they take reservations through a call center. They also supply reservations over the internet and assist our parks with registration of campers as they walk in. They also do reservations for our special facilities. So, without questions, I'll move into the policy packages. Let's go. Okay, I refer you to page 35 in your book. And the first package is 130, and this has to do with staffing issues. The first one is a request to establish two positions. One would be to establish a permanent position for our geographic information system. This was a limited duration position that was established last biennium when we began our project for this. And that has been underway for a while. We were granted some temporary funding for temporary services to help us with our initial data collection. We've also been working with other agencies to use and capture the data that they already have available, so we're not reinventing the wheel. The second position would be an information specialist four. That would be a technician responsible for making sure that the data is captured and maintained and kept current. There's really a lot of benefit that the department will receive from this. We do a lot of master planning for our parks facilities and our engineering groups and our natural resource preservations. The advantage of a geographic information system is you look at a picture or a map, and it allows you to drill down and find layers of information, you know, all the way down to where the sewer lines and the water lines run within the park. And as most of the systems that are really, really old, a lot of that was in our managers' heads, and you know, occasionally we are digging up something and come across a water line that nobody knew was there. So this would really help us facilitate that. It would also help us identify those natural areas, wetlands, sensitive areas like our archaeological sites that are within the parks.
Do you work with, like, Dogami and use their resources so you don't have to do it two or three times before being done?
Madam Chair, Representative Schaffler, that's okay. Correct. We draw from every source that's out there. The gentleman that we hired, we stole from Fish and Wildlife, and he's been doing a great job for us.
Great. Thanks a lot.
The next position within that package is a human resource analyst, and we are asking this to be a limited duration position. And that person would basically help our personnel and safety services section meet a couple of needs that we have. Our first is to assist us with some recruiting. We need to be a little more proactive in our recruiting and particularly helping us get some more diversity within our department. And we feel like we really need to focus a position or a half a position on helping us do that outreach to get a more diverse workforce. The other half of that position would be working with our safety and risk management areas. The paperwork that's involved in processing claims, even if our number of claims has gone down for our own employees, they generally seem to be of a severe enough nature that the paperwork is compiling in and of itself And also we're seeing more and more visitor claims that we need to process. Whether they're finally accepted or not is up to Department of Risk Management, but we still have to process the paperwork. Package 200 is...
Go back for a minute to package 130, the human resources analysis and the issues around injuries. Mm-hmm. There's a piece here that says, with the newly reinstated workers' compensation premiums, can you talk to us about what that's about?
Yeah, Madam Chair, for almost a decade, no state agency paid workers' comp insurance claims, I guess, or, to the Department of Administrative Services, because they had a reserve. Midway last biennium, I believe, they used up that reserve, and so last biennium was the first time we'd paid any workers' comp claims in, I think it was about a decade, and then this is the full biennium of charges. And so it's really up to the agencies to help manage those claims. They average your losses over a three-year period, and they give you some sort of grace if you have an extraordinary loss. We had a fire at our Rooster Rock, that whole gorge area of management unit, destroyed the building. Extraordinary losses like that are given a grace period, but over a period of time, you do have to pay for those losses. And so this is important. It's always been important for us to manage, but it's even more important now because it does impact our budget.
In the workers' comp arena, then, does each agency have its own experience rating based on past claims, or is there one experience rating for all of the agencies?
Madam Chair, it is based on the individual agencies. So there used to be what they called the Dirty Dozen, and it was a way of encouraging the agencies who had the most claims to work on getting those down, and I'm guessing that they might reinstitute that sometime. But yeah, each agency has their own loss record, and their rates are based on that loss record.
And that same concept now applies to liability issues, claims against the state's liability insurance policy?
Madam Chair, that's correct, yes. And we've paid those as an ongoing basis. It was really the workers' comp that was had developed a pretty good reserve.
Why was there a reserve? Was there an overpayment at one point that the reserve built up, or was it as a result of the workers' comp changes that we made 10 years ago? Or?
Chair Senator Bates, I'm going to defer to Lisa, and I'm not sure she even knows the answer to
that. Madam Chair, Senator Bates, we can get back to you. We had the answer of last session
written down.
That's all right. I'm just curious.
Probably both as well.
I guess the real thing I want to know is, are your workers' comp claims suddenly accelerating or going up, so you're losing your reserve, or is it just sort of a steady line thing and you have some reserves built up? I mean, the real question is if you have an increased number of compensation claims.
Madam Chair, Senator Bates, the reserve was either a factor of the reforms or changes back in the past, and so it has less to do with current changes and rates of injury, for example, than it does a historical occurrence.
Strange. We missed that one. We looked for money, didn't we?
It's kind of like accountability.
Yes. Well, I'm just concerned that they'll have an ongoing, you know, like an increase in claims, and that's why they run out of money. It's probably not. That's the key thing for me.
Please proceed.
Direct you to package 300, which is the reservation system upgrade. We've had a reservation system in process, but we've had one for years and years and years, but an electronic one has been in place for 9 years, I guess. About 1996, I think, is when it was put in place. The company that we contract for that service, Reserve America, was bought out by Ticketmaster, and in doing so, Ticketmaster has taken on rewriting the whole program and will be, over the next few years, phasing out the old software and requiring agencies that are using their system to move to the new application. We anticipate that this will be an improvement in terms of the technology that's available. It'll provide us some extra opportunities for point of sale, which we don't currently have in the system. And so we're fairly excited about this. And there's a couple of states that have already installed the new software, and the Reserve America folks are continuing to modify and develop that and continue to roll out new versions of it. We anticipate that our migration will not occur until probably late in the 05-07 biennium. And these costs, as presented here, are our and Reserve America's best guess at this time. As they modify the software and as other things change, the prices themselves may change as well. So, anyway, but we wanted to get something in front of you for that upgrade.
Senator Bates.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I assume that you looked at an open bidding system on, since you're being forced to move off one software to another. I assume you looked for a request for proposals from various software vendors before you made a decision to stay with one you're with already.
Madam Chair, Senator Bates, the way this is actually set up is we are entitled to upgrades of the system as long as we stay on their system. So this is a less costly solution than going out to get a new bid. So the original vendoring was competitively bid. We are in the process of developing a request for information to send out to see if there are any other products that provide the same kind of service. We've done some informal surveys of other states, large counties and stuff that operate reservation systems, and so far no one source provides that same breadth of service that Reserve America does. Interestingly enough, the feds just went out for a bid for all of their parks, and Reserve America was selected in that process. So, as far as we know right now, it is the best.
Pardon? How old is this system?
We installed it in 1996.
And was it updated subsequent to that?
I'm sure that's correct. There's been, I don't know how many versions of updates, but each one of those then is, we pay some incremental cost, but it's not like the full cost of implementing a whole new system. Or developing a whole new system.
Okay. I think the information that I'd like to have for the phase three discussion of the policy package is what it's going to do better than what we already have, what we can expect as outcomes in the reservation system mm-hmm. as a result of this investment.
Question,
go for it.
I'd like to know what percentage of your parks are covered by the reservation system. Is it 100%, 50%? The most popular parks?
Madam Chair, Senator Bates, there are actually 34 parks that are on the system entirely. And portions of other parks that have some special facilities also are going through the reservation system. That's roughly a little.
34, 52.
Yeah, so. There's 52 parks, so 34 is.
There are 52 campgrounds, so 34, 52.
Yeah, so 34.
How many sites do you are under the system then?
Chair, Senator Bates, I can't tell you, but I can find out.
Number of sites and total cost annually is what I like to see. The $150,000 says is increased over current, so I don't know what your annual maintenance for application is.
I think we also would be interested, if it's possible, in a like a cost per reservation or some kind of thing that we can track over time. And ideally, the reservations would be going up and the costs would be going down.
We'd be happy to provide that.
Will this allow full internet interactivity? Will people be able to come onto the internet and get just as good a service as they could get if they called in?
Madam Chair, actually, you can probably get better service because that's a 7x24. So if you get a hankering to go camping at 2:00 in the morning, you can get on your computer. And sites are reservable 9 months in advance. So the amount of internet reservations has continued to grow. We're about 34% right now of our reservations go that way. Special facilities like lodges or things like that. We have a call center because there's some special requirements and things, so they need to call in and talk to a reservation specialist about those. But our regular campsites are all reservable over the internet. And the last package on page 37 is a request to allow us to establish some petty cash funds. We have currently a revolving checking account that we use to buy small incidental kinds of things. And we, of course, do use the state's Visa card when that's appropriate for purchases. The reason we've asked to go this way is to give us some small amounts of cash to have on hand when there's, you know, they need to go buy a flashlight or something that, you know, is not warranting writing a check, and most small vendors would just assume you didn't use a credit card for something less than $5. So this would be in the parks and would be controlled through what they call an impressed petty cash account, so that every month it's reviewed and reimbursed and replenished based on the amount of expenditures that have been against that account. Managers would still be responsible for reviewing those purchases, and we'd anticipate, you know, petty cash accounts would probably be, you know, $50, maybe $100 or so in the larger parks. It would be a small amount of cash on hand.
So give me a total dollar amount that would be involved in this ballpark.
Madam Chair, I'm guessing probably maybe $10,000 total. That's just a rough off the top of my head guess.
I think that, as in the stage three discussion of this policy package, that we're going to be very interested in the controls over this. These are the kinds of things where, for $10,000, you spend $100,000 trying to keep track of it.
Well, Madam Chair, if I may, you know, we want to keep honest people honest, because it'll cost a lot more than $10,000 to house them in a penitentiary. For ripping us off. I couldn't agree more. This is dangerous stuff. Potentially dangerous.
Okay.
Madam Chair, Reverend Strothler, that's why we have an internal auditor.
Great. Thank you.
Yeah. And I can guarantee we handle a lot more cash than that on any given day.
Well, I think the issue is, with a small amount of money and the high degree of control, does the cost of the program, I mean, is it reasonable? That's the question that I'd like to have answered. Okay.
That concludes our policy packages. Yep. Budget presentation, and we want to talk about performance measures.
Let's go for it.
I think in a separate handout, we have a very small print, revisions that we made to our performance measures. And frankly, the discussion we had during the phase one budget was very helpful to get some different perspectives on our performance measures. What you have before you are 8 and potentially 9 performance measures, and that's down from 14, which we presented at the initial budget presentation. And very quickly, I just kind of like to walk you through them. Some of them are new, some of them are modified, and I just would like to point out what we're trying to get at here and see if we were have captured your ideas as well. But the first one is really modified. It's intended to measure the effectiveness of the grant programs in meeting local recreation needs, as documented, in recreation planning documents such as SCORP and other local recreation needs documents. And so what we are measuring here is the percent of the number of qualified grant applications that we get against the total number that we're allowed, that we're able to award. And that's a measure of A, whether we're meeting the need or not, and B, is there a need there for more funds in that program or not more funds in that program. So that's the objective of that. Before, what we were measuring was the total amount of dollars that went out through grant programs, and that counted local match that went to it and so forth. So we think this is a little better measure of that. Again, it's linked to an identified and documented need. The second measure and the third measure also have to do with the grant programs. They're more sort of business process measures, but they will measure the average number of days between the close of a grant application period and the notification of the applicant of whether the award will be made or not. It's a customer service issue as much as anything else. And measure three follows on by looking at how quickly we get the payments out the door. Since these are managed primarily as reimbursable programs, once we get the invoice to pay, we have to go through the process of validating it and ensuring it's correct and so forth, and make the payment. And this is a measure of how quickly we're able to do that. The standard here is 45 days, and I believe that's a state standard. But generally, we try to turn things around in 30 days. That would be a more of a business process measure. So those two are new. Item four is a repeat of the same item that occurred in our previous measures, and it was this comes out of the Oregon Population Survey, which is done by the Progress Board. And it's just an overall assessment of how Oregonians feel the state is doing in meeting their parks and outdoor recreation needs. And then a similar measure, which would be included in the Oregon Population Survey, would be asking the same question of how the state is doing with regard to preserving the state's heritage. The sixth item, you'll recall we had lots of good discussion about this. This item before was basically number of acres added to the state park system. And we had this discussion about, you can buy lots of acres, but are they meeting needs? And are they the kinds of acres that need to be purchased and brought into the park system, to protect resources or to provide a documented need? And so what we told you at the last session, and what our commission has already started doing, is developing a strategic sort of approach toward land acquisitions. And that strategic approach will consider need, documented need. It'll be done regionally, and so it'll look regionally at documented need, both recreation, resource management, natural area, and then also test that against what the capacity is for providing those services in that region. And so then we will prioritize acquisitions based on need and capacity by region. And so we will use those properties that have been identified as our sort of our baseline measure to determine if the percent of acquisitions that we are undertaking are coming from that list that we've identified as a need. So we think that's a more rational approach than just acres acquired.
So just to make sure that I'm grasping what you're telling me, we could look forward then to seeing a plan, a regional plan. Within each of those regions, you would be able to tell us what the needs are for different types of recreational opportunities, and then we would be able to see over time how the commission was fulfilling those needs.
I'm sure that's correct. Not just recreational opportunities, but sort of opportunities across the spectrum of the agency's mission, historic preservation and cultural resource protection as well. But yes, that would be the way this would work.
And so would there also be coming out of that some kind of prioritized list across the regions?
Madam Chair, yes. It would end up with, say, North Coast, and it would have, we haven't exactly got the document designed, but it likely would have, priority needs for meeting outdoor recreation or camping needs. And so it would identify, potential acquisitions to meet those needs. And if there are other needs that aren't being met in that region with regard to, say, preservation of cultural properties, then there would be a list of those as well. And so
that's what we would use to sort of target our acquisition program.
But what would be the process to take the camping needs in all the regions and decide which was the highest priority?
You mean across the state?
Uh-huh.
I'm not sure, Madam Chair, I'm not sure we've addressed that yet, but that's a question that we certainly...
I missed the phase one discussion in the committee, but in the discussion that the co-chairs and vice chairs had, there was a great deal of interest around a strategic plan on the part of the commission to be able to, in a meaningful way, assess what the needs were in the different across the different spectrums of programs that you offer. And then the regional part, I think, is a very valid way to attack it. But there also was great interest in how the decision would be made that Region A's priority in this particular category was a greater priority than Region F's priority in that same category. So I think that ultimately a performance measure for the acquisition needs would need to have those kinds of aspects to it. It would need to be regionalized, and it would need to be divided up by categories, and then we would somehow need to get that information as goals, as long-term goals, and then we would be judging the department's progress towards achieving those goals.
Madam Chair, I understand what you're saying, and we will certainly look at that as we develop this, see if we can make that.
Wait, I got all kinds of questions here. Senator Nelson, nothing?
I think he was.
Representative Schaffer?
I do have one, but I'll wait for these guys.
You've got about 100,000 acres in parks.
That's correct.
And 12,000 somethings in Curry County.
Representative Krieger, I don't know the exact
number. I believe it is. What I'm trying to get at is, you know, a small county with a disproportionate amount of parks, a county that's already over 75% federal lands, it has a huge impact on the tax base of property taxes, especially if it's valuable property that they take along the beaches and, you know, lakes or rivers or whatever it might be. So I would hate to envision a legislature in the year 3005. Well, can't buy anymore. We own it all, you know. And so it needs to be property that really fits a criteria of need. And just because there's a need, you may not be able to always fulfill it.
Madam Chair, Representative Krieger, you're exactly right. And one of the constraints that we would have, even by trying to be able to meet those priorities on a regional basis, is opportunity. And is, you know, although our department has the authority for condemnation, our policy is not to use that. Our policy is to buy from willing sellers. And so the ability to identify the need and work with willing sellers and find the properties that will meet those needs is, you know, is always a, will always sort of keep a plan in a state of flux, if you will.
And I recognize that, but I see this as being a somewhat parallel process that ODOT has in place with the regional groups of folks that prioritize the transportation needs across the state, and then the blending of the priorities within the regions to get a statewide hierarchy of needs or way to go or method to move in modernization and new highways and bridge repair and all the different kinds of categories that they have. And I do think that that is a huge need in this department, given the immense cash flow that you have with the Measure 66 funds coming in. I think that there is an increased level of concern in the legislature that we're kind of just throwing money at things to see if it'll stick, and that there is, I think, a desire to see a much more strategically thought-out way to invest this money so that we're actually buying things that have the greatest need in the recreation arena.
Madam Chair, I concur. I mean, and our commission has recognized this as well, so we're on the same.
I'm Jerry.
Senator Bates.
Early in the session, we had that same conversation with this group here at length for about an hour, hour and a half, and And we expressed our concerns, and they assured us that they were going to start working in that direction a lot more than they have in the past. I think it might have been in the beginning kind of a feeling that we can't buy anything except where a willing seller is, and we have some nice properties that came available to us, let's take it, but there may not have been a careful assessment of whether that was the property we needed absolutely in comparison to the needs of the state as a whole, and it was hard to assess that. They're working, trying to get that assessment down. Mm-hmm. We had a meeting in my office and mm-hmm. talked about that, and trying to figure out exactly what each area needs is difficult. It appears naturally that the areas in the northwest part of the state are probably the areas we want to concentrate on, because that's where people live. Mm-hmm. But that's not a given. And
acquisition issues in that area too.
That's right. It gets tougher and tougher. So even if you set up a plan where you think you need something in an area, being able to get something is a different story. And things may change. I mean, the federal government right now is selling off 4 or 5 pieces of property across the state, one of which I love to buy up in the Siskiyous. It's $3.5 million minimal bid, so it's not going to be part of my portfolio. But this is just because Siskiyous is something that's owned by the public doesn't mean it stays owned by the public. The federal government is selling off pieces, and you may find yourself someday selling off something you purchased this time also. But so the point being here is what the chair said I agree with and what we had a discussion about earlier. And I'm glad you started that process and are going to look at it carefully.
I think that it's very exciting to be able to plot the course for this, that we have an opportunity with the Measure $66, and it appears to be one of the few parts of the budget that's actually increasing in revenue over time. And to seize the opportunity and make the investments strategically, I think is a huge plus for the state of Oregon. So I'm very glad to hear that the commission is moving actively in that direction.
And that's why I'm glad people like Bill Gregory are around.
Yes.
Thank you, Bill.
Representative Schaffer.
You know, and plus, I don't know if the state in itself will ever make money, but our parks could be a huge money maker if we can find out what people want in them, and get them to go there, get them to go down to beautiful Curry County and spend their money in town while they're at the park. I mean, we may never make, the state may never make a profit, although it's possible, I think, but that kind of investment, find out what people want and then give it to them. Then they go to Curry County and spend all their money. That would be wonderful. And plus, if I may, Madam Chair, I don't think we spend enough money actually promoting Oregon or our parks. Now, maybe you may have a different answer to that. But for example, 2 years ago there was all this information going around about, and one thing that jumped out at me. I mean, Iowa spends more money on promoting tourism in their state than we do. Well, and you may argue for good reason.
They need to.
I grew up in Iowa. That's why it jumped out at me. But, you know, we have a treasure here, and you can make an argument that our Oregon's the most beautiful place in the world, and our state parks are a perfect example. So I really think there is huge opportunity here if we could find out what works and what people want and then give it to them and then go down to Representative Krieger's neighborhood and spend all our money.
Get
them
to take you out for dinner.
Right, exactly. I'd be happy to.
I've flagged over Curry County.
Yeah. But you're right. It is a great opportunity, and I hope we don't blow it.
Madam Chair, I have just one additional comment, is that I think what this plan will allow us to do is, as I've said, we've bought from willing sellers opportunistic in the past, but what this plan might allow us to do is identify some need or some particular piece of property and maybe go develop a willing seller. I think we share sort of your enthusiasm in putting this thing together.
So does anyone have any other issues they want to raise relative to these proposals for performance measures? Okay, we'll just put this one on the back burner then. Oh, we haven't finished them?
Finish?
We better finish them.
There was item 7 and 8.
Which, yes, that would be a good idea.
Tired, are you?
Item 7 is modified from the previous measure we had, where we were trying to measure the impact of our heritage conservation programs and our ability to protect historic properties. And it was, again, a measure of expenditures and wasn't really a measure of effect. So what we propose doing is simply measuring the number of sites that are protected. And as programs wax and wane. There may be opportunities to adjust or modify programs to continue to increase the amount of historic properties that are protected, and this will help us measure that. Number eight is the same as you...
Let's ask one question here. Sure. In a couple of these, you've got five-year rolling averages. You're talking about, I think, how that will even out the tops of the peaks and the bottoms of the valleys on the graph. What is the purpose of doing that? Why is it, do you think, reasonable to do that?
Madam Chair, in some programs there is variation in funding, more the case of federal programs like the Land and Water Conservation Money, where we had several biennia where we had funding. Prior to that, we had little to no funding. In the coming biennium, in the coming federal fiscal year, right now Land and Water Conservation Money is zeroed out, so that money wouldn't be available. So by allowing us to average that over time, it sort of smooths out the... it doesn't provide those big spikes in the program. So that's primarily the reason. If the base stays the same and there are no changes, then the five-year rolling average would be essentially the same as the annual average.
I would assume that we would all hope that the trending line was going up, that we were being able to get more properties or sites involved in these programs. But I'm going to have to think about this rolling average thing, because I'm not sure whether it might be better for the people that sit in this situation to have an understanding of why the numbers are going up and down, rather than and be able to take a look at that level of detail. So that probably is a phase three discussion on this one.
And actually, Madam Chair, that really is... When those numbers change, or when there's variation off that average, that's when management decisions or management actions need to be taken, or policies changed or something. So that would trigger that.
And it would be my concern that we would miss out on that level of discussion if we just had a trending.
Item eight again is the same as the measure in one of our earlier measures, and that just measures our success at reducing the backlog in maintenance and repair. And then item nine, there was, performance measure 14 previously was percent of general fund in the agency's budget. I think everybody concurred that really didn't tell us anything, because there's 0% general fund in there. What we were really trying to get at was at some measure near the end of the life of ballot measure 66, what is sort of the funding structure of the department going to look like, so we can make some decisions about how it's funded or how programs are changed or responsibilities are changed or whatever. And so what we would like to do is work on development of a measure that would identify core department functions, that if this is the only thing that we had to do mission-related, here's how we would organize to do it, and here's how we would fund it. And then once we figure that out, we can begin to figure out what the shortfall might be. And if there's a shortfall, then we can make decisions about whether that's, assuming that there's no Measure 66 money goes away, then we can make decisions about whether, do we make up all of that shortfall by using undedicated lottery money, or is that general fund money that goes in there, or is it a change to the fee structure or whatever? But it would allow us to have a conversation about what that might look like.
And so the proposal would be to develop this over the interim and then have something hopefully online to begin tracking things in the next biennium.
Sure, that's correct.
So we need to put some stuff in the budget narrative about JLAC.
Mm-hmm. And that's it.
Now we're done. Okay. You have just five more minutes, so this is probably a good place to break, because we're actually at the end of the agenda items that we have for today. Susie, can you talk to us about what we'll be looking at in the session that we have tomorrow?
Tomorrow we're going to look at the subcommittee's priorities for the agency and have the agency's response to that. go over the answers to questions from phase one. We have public testimony, and we have the two reports that we need to go into a work session for to approve or acknowledge received report for full complete review.
So with that, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 5056, and we'll reconvene tomorrow at 1 o'clock to conclude the hearing. Thank you very much.